Hello, my name is Tucker Johnson, and I am your host today as we experience NIMSY Live, where we talk about the latest and greatest in translation, localization, internationalization, culturalization, and all that fun stuff global companies need to delight their international customers. On this program, we invite guests who like to have fun and have some value to add for our audience of globalization professionals. I'm always eager to provide a platform to those with a good story or a good data set. So let us know if there are any topics you'd like covered or guests that we should reach out to for future episodes. If you haven't already done so, make sure that you are subscribed to NIMSY Insights. We are coming to you live today on LinkedIn, of course, X, Facebook, and Twitter, the same as X, and YouTube, of course, where all of our old episodes are archived. If you want to check out past episodes of NIMSY Live, head on over to NIMSY Insights YouTube page and find the playlist called NIMSY Live, and you can learn all about it there. We also are available as a podcast, not live, of course, but if you have a trip coming up and need to download some podcasts for that long flight, go over to Spotify, Apple Music, Amazon, wherever you get your podcast, that's where you'll find us. And just search for NIMSY Live, and you can download as many episodes as you like. Without further ado, I'm going to get right into it today because we're talking about something that I always like talking about because it's something that, frankly, I don't know as much as I would like to about, which is game localization. And game localization has come a long ways from the early days of patchwork processes and last-minute translations. Today, we are doing an episode featuring Michael Soto from Gridly as we rewind the clock to explore how localization used to be done and how far the industry has come. Michael brings a rare blend of experience from both sides of the table over a decade as a game producer on titles like Time Splitters 2 and Commandos, followed by a transition into localization solutions with Localized Direct and now Gridly. His journey gives him a unique holistic view of where localization fits in the development lifecycle and where it falls short. And without further ado, I'm going to bring you up here on screen. Michael, welcome to the show. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Tucker. Lovely to be here. Thank you for the intro. That was absolutely perfect. Although it might make me feel kind of nostalgic because I was kind of thinking about, okay, the stuff that I've done. I actually kind of dug out an old copy of Cutthroats. I don't know if people can see that.
Cutthroats.
Cutthroats. That was actually the first title I worked on at IDOS all those years ago.
Back when titles actually had packaging and you would wait in line at the store to buy them on release day.
You could open and stuff like that.
Yeah, back in the good old days before digital rights management and all of that horse shit that we deal with now. And I'm assuming you're a gamer.
That's how you can tell.
It's like the Dunning-Kruger test for people that play video games. Like, those that actually play video games are very hesitant to say, yes, I'm a gamer, because they know the connotations that come with that. So it's like, yeah, I play video games, but I'm not a gamer.
I haven't played, like, solidly for quite a bit. I kind of dip in and out of stuff, and then my son might be playing something, and then I'll sit down and we'll play together and stuff.
I was gonna say, you have kids. That's what that means. Yeah. That's what that tells me. Yeah. Now I watch my kids play Minecraft, and maybe once a month I'll log into my Path of Exile account and waste a weekend. But that's about it.
Yeah, it's funny that kind of grind time, like for that your Zeldas and things like that. It's kind of like I really kind of got into Zelda, got into Harry Potter, and Hogwarts. And, you know, you get into those, but then you have to really put a lot of time into those games. I just simply trying to find that time to do that.
Yeah, it's hard to find a game these days that you can actually just, like, casually play. Like, they require a lot. But anyways, this isn't a gaming podcast. Yes. This is a localization podcast. Maybe
another time.
We need to start another one. Maybe we can co-host a gamer podcast. But I want to... I gave you a brief introduction, but you have a really interesting background. You've been client side, vendors. You've been around. You've worked on a bunch of different stuff. Tell us a little bit about yourself to get us started here.
Sure. Well, it was So started off at IDOS back in early '98, which is obviously hugely dating. So I joined there actually in localization as a coordinator with IDOS, and then went from that after 6 months, then became an AP, and then kind of just progressed through there. And so started very much on Cutthroats and the Commandos mission pack. And so I managed to see from the real in-depth kind of view on how localization was actually managed within a publisher. And then taking that then all the way through to kind of looking after kind of other, you know, other multiple titles at the same time with other APs and producers, and actually, you know, and you know, and having that experience of, you know, what the publisher kind of what they, how they kind of grade and how they kind of how they conceptualize what they're trying to achieve, whether or not, you know, it's actually just the pursuit of bottom line, is it the pursuit of gaming excellence? So you kind of see a real kind of a blend of all kinds of requirements. And then when you kind of, when after seeing kind of a lot of the localization kind of issues and so many things that kind of repeated themselves over and over again, it was then kind of right, well, there's definitely an area within this business where a localization, a standardized localization solution would make a lot of sense. And so that's why kind of moving into that, we've now kind of developed a system that allows that to then happen. So yeah, so that's the kind of, so now that's been 15 years doing that. I'm still today, well, not today so much, but maybe a few years ago, still seeing a lot of the same stuff that happened back in 1998.
Yeah.
Still happening today. And it's like, well, things have changed for sure, but there's lots of things that haven't changed.
Well, it's not just gaming localization. And I want to get into all of that, the, you know, the conversation about like how many people are still sending Excel files back and forth. And yeah, I we'll get into it. We'll get into it. Don't worry. But, you know, as I mentioned, I've never worked in gaming localization. I've worked my entire career in localization and gaming localization. I always was interested in it, and I've worked for companies. I've worked on many RFP responses trying to get into gaming localization. But in my I never worked at a company that specialized it. In my experience, it was always really hard to break into that field from the vendor side. Because clients wanted the known entity, clients wanted the experience, clients wanted Keyword Studios, right? They wanted
Inari and all that.
Yeah, exactly. Those companies. And it was really hard to break into. And I was always told, well, if you don't have experience, you don't get it. And it's super, this is an industry where it's super important that you bring experience to the table, specifically in gaming localization. And I want to ask you, like, why? Why is that? What is so different about gaming localization?
I think it's, in part, I mean, there's a few kind of levels to that. I think there's the fact that we were all ex-game people as well. So the kind of the people that created localization were had that history of what's required from game localization in terms of how it can then work with the developers themselves, and I think that was a very vital part of it. Also, the fact that you have to have specialized translators as well. And I think that because we decided very early on we wanted to very much focus on games because of our own kind of histories as well, then obviously we then recruited people that was their specialty in actually working with gaming, understanding gaming use, understanding platform terminology, all of that kind of stuff that was was absolutely vital to us. So we could then go out and say, right, we are offering this service. These people absolutely know what they're doing. These people have won awards. These people are, you know, they're all the kind of the really, really great people to do this. So that's kind of, I think that certainly helped. But what was the initial kind of attractor there was having that technology. So we developed LockDirect first. And so as that was then being used at various developers, they would then say, well, now it's in here. Can we get somebody to come into the system and then work in the system rather than then having to deal with someone else? And so from that point, we then developed the team even further to then allow for those people that could work directly.
Okay, so you're kind of, well, tell me about LockDirect.
Yeah, so it was kind of, again, it was, yeah, so it was, so LockDirect was the brainchild of Chris and Matthias, who work at Gridly as well. So basically they kind of, again, felt the pain for years and years of this kind of, you know, changes need to be tracked. You know, if you are meant to rescue the prince and the prince is now a dragon and that doesn't get then communicated and related in the text itself, then obviously it breaks the game and that's rubbish. So it started from that point there, and it was kind of, right, so because of that experience and then the understanding that people could really benefit from having this opportunity to house their content effectively or efficiently, that then created LockDirect itself. And LockDirect, it was Very, very useful. It wasn't cloud-based. It was client-server, so that, and that was, of the time as well. And I think that what we've now found that, over time, we've been able to take BlockDirect and all the great kind of learnings that have been experienced from that, and then develop Gridley, which is what's currently available now, which kind of takes all the really good stuff from BlockDirect and then makes it far more accessible. And there's loads of other kind of functionalities in there. But yeah, so it kind of started from that point there of, this is kind of broken and crappy, and loads of first parties have their own systems and they've invested in their systems. And back in the day, IDOS tried to, and we had a system that worked, but it just required a lot of support as well. And I think that, unless you're willing to put all that support and the cost associated with that support into it, then you are going to really struggle to kind of have a viable and ever-changing and ever kind of supported platform. So that's it. So a lot of people have those, a lot of people don't have those. And so we wanted to make sure that everyone could have that access.
Well, let's back up maybe a little bit and talk to me. Kind of the title today is Game Localization Since 1999. What's changed? So maybe let's go back to basics and start there. What does game localization look like for someone that's never been involved with it? Is it very a manual process? Is it super automated? Are there specialized tools and repositories? Walk us through, start back in 1999 and walk us through the last quarter century.
Yeah, well, they say it was super Wild West back then. I think you had, there was things like that's pretty early days of renderware, or renderware was certainly being used, and certainly there was initial kind of Unreal around that time as well, but it was all very much, there were text files, and text files would be crammed with source, or there'd be a file and it'd be crammed with code, for example. And it's kind of like, okay, so how can we take this and then be able to then just take out the translatable parts and then work on those? And so there was no kind of real way for this to be achieved rather than kind of manually going through, or, and that's why a lot of people really didn't want to localize. They were kind of like, what, can we give this to another company? And so they would then have, so actual kind of porting companies would come in that would not only kind of look after taking that code and then maybe putting it onto PS1 or whatever it might be, but also then actually doing the localization side of it. And you would actually get companies from Russia or from Japan, et cetera, who would actually come to you as a developer and say, can we do the Japanese version? Can we do the whatever the version was, and take it away from them? At which point most people would go, yes, please, you look after it. But obviously this then changes over time, where people start, and again, this is the whole kind of thing where for those long-standing lock professionals, they've seen it, they've done it. When it comes to game lock, they've seen it, they've done it, they kind of understand. I'll just explain. So normally everything will be associated to a string ID. That's the kind of the main thing. And so that allows you to take that file and then export, take that file, have that file translated according to that string ID. And what it will then do is that whatever engine you're using will then look at that string ID, and then if you have the English version loaded up or the source version or whatever it is, it will then pull all of that relevant data into that version. If you then change that flag to then be French or whatever, then it would pull the French version, French content in. So it's all based on that string ID. So we regularly see a lot of content from non-games which don't have those types of things. It's just like a big block of text, or they might be using Figma or whatever it might be that maybe hasn't got a specific one that they can then reuse with their development environment. So yeah, so what we then have is, so games very much string ID based, ideally not duplicate string IDs. That's another thing which is kind of like, oh, why isn't this working? Is there a duplicate string ID? Yes, there is. Right, so we've got that. So, but what's changed over time is then obviously the kind of the introduction of Unreal Engine, of Unity, which provided a greater framework, which allowed the developers to actually create files that they could then provide to an LSP, to a localization house, to then have that local house work on it and then send it back. So that really did evolve over time. But you had those long-standing lock people, well, I'm not gonna say names, but you know who you are, and those guys would kind of know, right, these are the pitfalls, these are the things that regularly can go wrong, so let's make that not happen. And so that's fine, and they will always look after that. But you've just got so many people that don't, and until it bites them, then they kind of understand it. But even then, the amount of times I was in post-project reviews where these had been communicated, but still happened every time was amazing, quite frankly. But yeah, that's the thing. Even with the longstanding guys, there's always stuff that can jump up and bite you in the butt.
Oh, yeah. There's always something new in this industry. And I think, from my understanding, and when we're talking about gaming localization, there's a lot of just standard pitfalls and things in localization that non-localization people don't understand. That's why we have jobs, because it's not their job to understand it. That's why we exist, right? So I understand that, having to go in and solve all these problems that other people haven't even thought of, you know, even if they are conscious that this content needs translated, so I need a way to be able to export it and import it, you know, maybe that's as far as they've thought. They haven't thought about, well, maybe syntax across different languages is different. Maybe, you know, text expansion is a thing, you know, leaving aside encoding issues for, I mean, that's a whole different conversation that's, you know, largely solved nowadays. But these are things that are relevant to anyone working in localization, but I think hyper magnified when you actually talk about gaming localization is because of the complexities. So you can talk about, like, you know, say document translation, website translation, and then it gets more complex as you start adding more multimedia type of things. So you go into multimedia entertainment, you know, whether it's, you know, video, films or whatever, it gets a little bit more complex. I was talking to someone yesterday about, you know, dubbing and lip syncing and all of that stuff. And then you take it one more level, especially with what we see in with games today, because games have all of those complexities plus this dynamic environment, right?
Yeah,
things
yeah,
are highly right. customized. Like, you can customize your own character. You can have, you know, if you're playing, I don't know, it's like The Witcher 3. It's been a while since I've really right? But if you're playing like The Witcher 3, you know, it's like there's so many different branching paths.
Sure.
And the amount of content is just amazing, right? Yeah. We're not talking about localizing a 2-hour movie or a 10-minute e-learning course. We're talking about localizing hundreds of hours, and that requires voiceover acting, right? So even the actors, you need to pull all these actors into a studio. They need to record their lines. They need to know the context of those lines in order to record them. It's just so complex.
Yeah, and it flexes until the very end as well. It's very rare that a game will finish at the point it's meant to finish, and then you can then have all that extended period to then test it and just fine tune it and make it all delicious and all the rest of it, because stuff always ends up shifting. All, you know, it's, I think it's just totally natural that it does that. And of course, but then of course then there's all the market requirements of this has to ship by this quarter or whatever it might be. So you've got all of these things to bear in mind as well. And games, very specifically games, you know, you are fine-tuning a demo until the last minute. You are, you know, the tutorial, for example, you're fine-tuning that right to the, like, oh, you know, this could feel a bit better if somebody plays it in a certain way or whatever. So that's being tuned right to the end. Now, if there's audio in that tutorial as well, then that knocks it all on as well. So there's all these things that can happen right until the very last second, which, you know, again, all needs to be tracked properly, and all, you know, and it all just takes then more testing time. So you need to make sure your testing turnaround is crazy fast as well, because if it's not, then you're going to be losing day after day. Where, you know, I remember driving down the M4 in my car with the Gold Master, you know, from a place called Bristol in the UK back to Wimbledon in London, you know, at, you know, 2-3 in the morning or whatever it was, with the Gold Master in my possession, to make it just in time to then hit, you know, this timeline to hit this timeline.
Yeah.
And it's like, geez. You know, thank God those days are gone now.
Well,
with a slightly faster internet.
Well, that's one thing I want to ask you about. You know, with the it's industry norm now, not just in gaming, but in a lot of different places. It's industry norm now to be able to push real time updates. You know, day one patches are a thing.
Yes.
So like the rush to make a game, a title perfect before you hit the, you know, print and ship button. Those days are over. It doesn't need to be perfect.
Right.
Your opinion, is that a blessing or a curse for industry?
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely, I mean, well, I suppose there'll be people on both sides.
Right. But, I mean, it's kind of a contentious thing online, gaming circles, especially online, because it's like, I think, you know, devs have lowered the bar a little bit because they're, we can fix it, you know. And it's like, you know, those day one gamers, those day one purchasers are kind of the new beta testers nowadays. So,
yeah, I don't know, as much as you don't want to say, but yeah, that does very much seem to be the case.
So there is that, but the good thing is it provides us the opportunity to constantly be improving things. And there's, you know, if something is identified, it's not just a bug that's going to live there in perpetuity. It's something that you can come and fix at any time. And how has that affected the localization workflow and process and the approach to localization?
Well, I think it's still, you know, developers still want to have that kind of that gold master, that shippable product that goes out and then it can be added to. I think on the whole patching side of thing, I think it was regularly a case of, you know, so in the UK we had PC Zone and Gamer, and you'd have the discs on the front of that and you'd update that way. And then obviously the patches got bigger and bigger, and then, you know, people were then, and then, you know, games were being shipped and they actually had kind of, you know, pretty major bugs in them. I think that's what you're saying, where that whole kind of, you know, as a game, as you know, as a one of the kind of the first plays of a game, you want it to be a perfect play experience. But I think that's very, very rarely a thing these days, because you kind of go, right, day one, people, as soon as they kind of put the disc into their slot, there's a update happening at that point there. So you've got that time from when the disc has gone to DADC or wherever it's where it's being manufactured to then arriving, you've got that time there. So that's a tremendous thing from a localization perspective. It does, you know, the games used to ship. I would say that localization was never really a big issue with physical product, or, you know, actually kind of hitting the market and being as it should be. I think it was more a case of it was functionality things that had to be fixed, as people maybe had early access or whatever, and they were able to then test those things and then feedback those things, and so they then had to go into a patch. But I think localization wise, I think sometimes there would be, you know, there were things like, wasn't noticed, but maybe swear words had made it into the Italian version or whatever. Yeah. And actually, you know, that was acceptable, but didn't then work with the PEGI rating or whatever it was. So that was definitely a thing.
Yeah.
Well, where it's like, right, that needs to be patched.
it's a whole nother level of consideration when talking about game localization, because it is an industry that is regulated. It's not regulated. It's monitored, let's say. And there's not really great international standards, like globally accepted. You know, every country is going to have its own laws and rules and regulations around, you know, violence and blood and, you know, language and different
swastikas.
Yeah, stuff like that, you know. And, you know, I'm sure we could sit here and discuss 10 different case studies. We probably studied the same case studies, right? Of FUPAs in game localization. Yep. So there's that component as well that just makes it a little bit more tricky. And how much is that of that is the role of the localization team versus, I mean, is the localization team a developer, for example, are they responsible for knowing all of that stuff and actually adapting it? Like true localization, like localization as it should be? And because in the rest of the localization industry, we kind of use this term localization to refer to translation.
Mm-hmm.
Even though localization is supposed to include more, and it's always been kind of my perception, correct me if I'm wrong, that in gaming localization, that's like one of the last niches where localization actually means localization.
Oh, for sure. I mean, that's, you know, you have, so there's the translation side of things. There'll be lots of questions go backwards and forwards, and the actual kind of the changing of text. So certainly on that side. But then you actually have localization testers actually going through it and actually spending time. And some of them are super crazy brilliant game players, but they're linguists as well, so they're all obviously able to pick up things where stuff doesn't sound like that, you know, in that particular instance how that character would sound in reality and how it should be in the game. So there's always kind of, these people are meant to pick up all of these things, that even if there's, and certainly if they're cultural or if there's something where you kind of think, well, that's acceptable in this in this territory, but that's clearly not, it's clearly irking me, or this is something that I don't feel comfortable and I don't think that other people will feel comfortable, then that obviously a bug is created back in the day, back in Bugzilla or whatever it was. So that would then be reported on and they need to have that understanding. But the thing is, a lot of the time, the people actually localizing it will pick up a lot of this stuff as well, because they understand games too. Yeah. They're not just, you know, they're just looking at the language, they're looking at how that is then used. So more often than not, a lot of the questions that we will receive, or that developers will receive, will be contextual ones. So, you know, so what's happening in it? There's always all the gender stuff, of course.
Well, you know, is it, okay, you brought it up. I wasn't going to go down that route. But it's like, you know, you go into certain online spheres when it comes to gaming, and there's lots of opinions out there with gamer circles. And, you know, the good news I would think about the industry is it's an industry where you don't really ever need to wonder what your audience thinks about you because they're very vocal online.
Okay, yeah, this just is a great area, sure.
Go to Reddit, go to Twitter, go to YouTube and see what the players of your game are saying about your game. NIMSY Insights doesn't do a lot of user perception studies for the gaming industry because I think everyone kind of knows the feedback's out there. From what I can tell, just, you know, kind of being around some of those like in gamer communities online, is there is this perception, and you actually hear the word localization used a lot because there's a lot of complaints about game localizers kind of changing things that they shouldn't, or, you know, getting into, yeah, like you brought up the pronouns thing, right? You know, pronouns, we have a whole debate about the use of pronouns here in the U.S. Mm-hmm. There's a perception out there that this is a very U.S.-centric thing, and some U.S. companies are trying to impose it on other languages that don't want it. I've talked to Spanish localizers that want to use, you know, about pronoun usage and gender stuff like that in Spanish and other languages. Mm-hmm. And there doesn't seem to be a consensus on this yet. So in a world where there's not much of a consensus, like you're either going to piss off side A or you're going to piss off side B. How do you navigate that as a localizer?
Yeah, that's the issue. I mean, it was always, and it's always been a recommendation as well, is to try to make the character gender, I mean, actually it makes life so much easier for everyone involved if that character could be completely gender neutral. So really, so what you try to do, so rather than kind of referring to he's and she's and having characters that are very clearly one or the other, or, you know, whatever you want to say, is actually to have, you know, a blob of something, or to have a gender neutral ghost, whatever those yeah. things might be, is to then, because then you can then just use they all the time, or you can just, you know, you don't have to worry about that and make them gender neutral. So that was always kind of like, always something that was that people always would like to do, because then once you went into the localization space, you had to then make sure that you had branches that would then cater for that kind of all that dialogue that happens within with the central character or the main kind of avatar, and then speaking to whomever that might be, because that obviously then varies. But then you've got the ability to then choose between a male or a female character at the start. Your actual avatar is one or the other, which then adds a whole nother layer of madness to the game as well. So yeah, so that then is obviously all of these trees, all of the placeholders have to allow for this for a system that will pull the correct translation for that particular interaction, which is a huge testing process as well that's required. Well, so that's the thing. So I think that what will then happen is, if it, you know, there will need to be another arm of, okay, so this is now going to be the you know, there's going to have to be a third option. You're going to be able to choose the male, the female, and then a gender neutral one or whatever, and it'll work like that. Or you just only have male characters in the whole game, or only female characters in the whole game.
That's not problematic.
That could get rid of it. But that's the thing, you know, and there's kind of this gender in kind of in weapons, and there's gender in kind of in items of furniture, whatever those things are as well. So it's kind of, it's really, really complicated, especially from a gaming perspective, because of the flexibility of how things can work, especially if it's truly free. Then Jesus Christ, you know, there's a lot of work that needs to be done.
Especially from an English speaker perspective, content author perspective, because if I'm an American, and let's face it, most Americans, we took a semester of Spanish in high school and that was about it. And so we're completely oblivious to the fact that in other languages, every noun has a gender, right? And it affects what the translation looks like. Every noun has a gender. We don't realize things like in some languages, the words that I use are going to change depending upon the gender of the person I'm talking to, right? Mm-hmm. So we don't even think about these things, but they're all things that need to be accounted for when you go into localization. And this is why, like, when I'm talking about, you know, hours and hours and hours, hundreds of hours of voiceover and, you know, a bunch of content, you know, I've seen some of the budgets for these big title localization. It's a lot of money. It's a lot of effort to localize one of these titles just for the sheer amount of content. One of the reasons that it's because you have all of these branches. It's not just like one set of dialogue all the way through. It's like, well, okay, we need to record this line twice depending upon the gender of the player character, right? Sure. Or whatever it may be.
No, absolutely. I think, you know, there's, you know, a really kind of valid point there where, you know, you've got, you know, back in the day, people really didn't, so going back to the 1999, generally, the, you know, people didn't really want to localize. They looked at localize as a real kind of pain point.
Yeah.
You know, because of this, you know, doing it in the UK, for example, was like, okay, we just, yeah, this is how it works and everything's nice and easy. And then somebody from the Spanish office then says, right, we need to do this. And you're like, oh, Jesus, you know, we have to do all this stuff too. Yeah. So that's kind of, it's like people didn't really want to do it. People now understand that localization shouldn't be seen as a pain point. It should be seen as a thing that should be done, but is super beneficial. But back then, there was the kind of thought, well, I'm doing this work and I'm not really going to get a huge number of units and whatever. And that would seem to be the general kind of view on was it worth to localize or not. And it takes a lot of convincing. It's like, well, you know, we're just going to ship English and that'll be fine because everyone speaks English, right? And it's like, well, you know, they kind of don't, but so what you should, and especially, you know, European, so for example, Pyro, for example, they would actually be developing a Spanish version to start off with. So they already had that in mind. So I think that what you found is with a lot of non-English speaking development studios, they would already have a concept of what needed to work there. So actually their localization process wasn't anywhere near as complicated as going from an English source and an English studio into those languages. So regularly the Americans would, and the Americans were the worst for this. Sorry, Americans.
Well, because we're not thinking about it, right?
It's like, well, we don't want to do it. So unless, you know, and there was, you know, they're could have been contractual kind of, well, you'll have to sue us then if you want us to do this version, yeah, you know, yeah, kind of thing. So so those things did happen as well. And it was a real kind of reluctance because I think people saw it as, well, I've finished the English, we QA it, kind of wrap it up so it's lovely and beautiful, and then we go on holiday.
They want to pop the champagne.
We go on holiday, like, yeah, we get our bonuses, we go on holiday, yeah, everything is good. But now it's like, yeah. Now you got to this point, well, now we're going to have to do this too, please, because then you can sell loads of units in all these lovely places.
Yeah.
It's like, right, well, we don't want to do that. So.
Well, and I know English is, correct me if I'm wrong here, but my understanding is like Ubisoft, for example, French company, they develop in English, right? Like they speak English internally for the most part.
I
believe that's my understanding. Don't quote me on that, audience. But from my conversations with other people in the industry,
right,
like they develop in English. However, like Japanese companies, they develop in Japanese.
For sure.
And so they're going to be inherently at an advantage because from day one, they're thinking about the localization because they know that they're going to need to sell their product in other markets. So, you know, they'll develop in Japanese and then they'll have that English translation going on simultaneously and they'll use that English as the source to translate into other languages. So it's really important to get that English right. But they're thinking about it from day one. And I guess my question to you is, in the last 25 years in the industry, how much awareness has happened or has come out of, how much has it changed that people are more aware from day one in the dev cycle that this is going to be localized into other languages? Is it still an afterthought? Is it still, oh crap, I thought we were finished, now we need to do localization?
I think it's involved a lot more in courses. I think, you know, the actual, you know, the idea of it being in a gaming course back then would be absolutely ridiculous. But certainly, I think now, you know, there are modules that are dedicated to localize to game localization. So I think that so there's certainly more awareness of the requirement there. But there's also the kind of the I think, you know, back in the day as well, because there was physical media. Regularly, a lot of games wouldn't make it over to the US or to Europe if it's Japanese, because it was like, well, that's the kind of game that's not really going to fly in Japan. So actually, let's not really worry about it, and vice versa as well. So I think, you know, you had stuff like, you know, GoldenEye was one of the kind of the rare few first-person shooters that really, really did well over in Japan. So it's kind of like, you know, you have, you know, there's certain types of games that wouldn't make it over anyway, or just wouldn't make sense. And then there's other games that are actually they're so wordy that unless they are unbelievably good games, they're just simply not going to make it into those languages as well, that where maybe English proficiency is quite low, because there's just too much cost to actually make that into that other language. But I think when it comes down to kind of considerations made as to whether or not things should kind of go into kind of totally different alphabet territories, then I think that people are far more aware of that. I think, you know, the whole kind of playing Japanese games was reasonably niche back then, but now we're, you know, people are playing a lot more Japanese games. People are far more into anime, manga than they ever used to be. So I think that people, you know, and a lot, you know, the idea of making, you know, creating any kind of anime in France or in, well, I suppose you have Ulysses and stuff kind of, but you know, stuff like that being made in Western territories was completely ridiculous. But now you're seeing a lot of really good stuff coming out of Western territories as well as Japan. So I think there's that kind of cultural thing has really kind of exploded. So I think people are far more mindful of, I really want to sell this in Japan, because I think Japan will love this, and vice versa, I think.
Yeah, I remember it back in the day. It's like, if there was a Japanese game, because I remember I was a big Final Fantasy fan. You know, it's like, how come I can't get all of the Final Fantasy titles in the U.S., right? And I remember the day that I could, like, figured out I could download an emulator and get these titles that just weren't for sale. Absolutely. Not that I would ever pirate games in an emulator.
No, of course not. But I had friends that would play just Japanese games. They were just, and it's like, what on earth are you doing? How can you know what you're doing next? It's like, well, you know, you kind of get used to what does this and what does that, and it's like, wow, that's some dedication right there.
Well, yeah. We've talked a lot about like these different complexities, and you know, and I want to turn the conversation a little bit to Gridley. You're with Gridley now, and so you're shouting from the rooftops about Gridley. And I know this isn't a sales pitch or anything, but I do want to talk about Gridley, because I think it's a good form or a good framework to have a conversation about what are some of the complexities in gaming localization or in entertainment or in any type of localization. What are some of those complexities and what's being done to address those complexities? And we can kind of use the tool as a framework to talk about those, because obviously you're not developing a tool with for every feature that you release in a tool, there's a story behind it. There's a challenge that needed to be addressed there. So walk us through Gridley. What is Gridley? How long has it been around? What does it do? Who is it for? Give me the sales pitch to start, and then I'll ask probing questions.
I'll still keep it relevant. Yeah. but certainly, so the whole kind of the purpose behind Gridley is very much that kind of that single source of truth. And I think that's what we discussed earlier on today, was the whole kind of, you know, Excel files flying around, you know, text files with source code in them, you know, all the rest of that kind of stuff with the code in them. You know, what Gridley will do is it will then interface directly with the system that you're using. So whether or not that's through Unity or Unreal plugins, or whether or not you want to then use the API to hook in with your particular system, or if you want to hook into a separate solution that you're using. So the whole thing is that we're still finding ourselves in a position where there's still manual files being sent around. And as soon as something leaves something, then obviously it's open to whatever can happen to it. Whereas if it's all being tracked, if there's a full history, if everything's kind of being monitored at all points, and who made that change, when that change was made, etc., then you have that ability to control. With stuff like Google Sheets, That's excellent. That was a massive game changer. But the problem you have is control again, and then access rights is another problem as well. So again, you know, Gridly allows that to take place. So you make sure that the content you want to share with a particular group of people is exactly what they get to see and what they can interact with. It's also the fact that, you know, having this kind of ability to press a button and that text to appear in Gridly, to then be worked on by the translation teams, wherever they might be, at whatever time they are. You're not waiting for somebody to manually push a file into somebody's inbox or anything like that. And you can actually pull that then back into the system as well. So you've got that push from Unity or Unreal or whatever, and then again, then a pull. So you can then press that button and then it pulls all of that content back in again. So that in itself is a massive game changer because, you know, again, going back to the old days, Pyro developed a version, you know, people like EA, et cetera, they all developed their versions as well. But again, people outside of those big businesses didn't and weren't able to. So that's, you know, so Gridly does that. It's the ability to branch content.
Well, and that can kind of be, that can kind of be problematic as well. Not to be like cat tool elitist or anything, but like when you see developers or client side organizations developing their own localization tools, you know, I like, stay in your lane, right? Like, let the vendor side manage that, right? Just because sometimes it's always done with the best of intentions, right? But not a lot of forethought. And I've just seen it happen so many times where you end up, you know, because I've worked my career on the vendor side, just for transparency. And I've worked with some large companies that have developed their own TMS, content translation memory, cat tool, whatever you want to call them, tools. And it was actually more work for us because we would have to develop all new tools to manage the inadequacies of that. And my understanding here is, like, I think the gaming industry best practice is, you know, it's for a long, maybe not best practice, but practice for a long time has been managing translation via text files or spreadsheets, right? There's still a lot of spreadsheets going around. So this kind of meets in the middle, kind of is able to inherit that spreadsheet culture, but put it into a more translation environment, translation friendly environment. Is it a cat tool? Is it a content system? Is it a TMS? Like, what is it? So if I'm using Gridly, would I then, you know, it syncs directly to the engine and pulls files out or pulls content out. That's great. It puts them back in. Am I translating, or my translator's translating directly in Gridly, or do I need to have a third party TMS? What does that look like?
Your choice. One's choice. So basically from that initial push or from wherever that source is held, if it's Unity or Unreal, then once it's in Gridly, you can choose to create a file. So it's very much it's managing that content. So you can create a file which you can then send to the LSP, or you can choose to push it to MemoQ or Phrase. We have those plugins as well, so they can go to LSPs that have those. So they can work that way. But we have recently released a TMS and CAT modules as well for people to try out. But certainly we want to keep it flexible. So if you want to keep it within Gridly, great. And then you can have that. You can invite the translators in, they can work within there. If you want to push it to MemoQ and Phrase, you can do that too. If you want to create a file and then just send that file, that's fine as well. That gets tracked.
Okay.
So although that file's left the system, it doesn't ever truly leave. It's worked on. Then when it comes back, if anyone's changed any content or there's, you know, any value diffs in there, then basically the warnings will be flagged and basically say, this has changed since this went out for translation. How would you like to manage that change? So all of those things are being catered for as well. But yeah, we wanted to, you know, the key thing was not creating this super rigid system where you have to go from here to here to here and follow these steps. So it's, you know, it gives you that flexibility. And again, with Gridly itself, the content side of things, again, you can kind of set it up in the way that you want to set it up. It provides a very loose frame that you can then choose to kind of house things in databases, in grids themselves. You can have multiple grids. The like you were saying about Excel files, you know, the ability to work within a 17 tab Excel file and then track what's changed in that and all the rest of it is like good grief. And yeah, you know, we know that, you know, the Japanese developers and Korean and Chinese developers, they love an Excel file with loads and loads of tabs. So basically, we've kind of said, right, well, we definitely need to make sure we can deal with that. So yeah, so the ability of taking that file and pulling it into a grid where it's easily kind of visual and you can find all the content you're looking for is kind of really important to us as well. But yeah, that's the whole thing. It's kind of create some kind of some structure, but allow people to kind of really kind of work with the way they want to work in it. And, you know, that's outside of, you know, the actual kind of the housing of localization files. You can have dependencies in Gridly. So you can have, so if you have a screenshot that is based on some text, then you can then have it set up so that when the text goes out of date, then the screenshot is also out of date. Wow. And that's the kind of stuff that which regularly is broken too, right? It's always like, well, this screenshot doesn't relate to this text at all. So yeah, so anyway, that's another thing. On to you.
No, it's important in any project. And I think this is one of the challenges about working vendor side. And also one of the rewarding things, if you like a good challenge, is that no two companies are the same, no two localization programs are the same. And it's impossible to build a tool or a solution or a process or a workflow that works for everybody. So in order, and there's a whole freaking marketplace environment, you know, market for TMS and LangTech, language technology out there. Mm-hmm. And the reason that whole market, the market size of the LangTech market, as far as like revenue, so the market size should not be able to support the number of players there are in the industry when compared to other industries, right? It is very fragmented, there's tons of players out there for a market size that's really not that big in the grand scheme of things. And the reason the market's able to support so many different players is because there is a need for all of these different little niches out there. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I say it many times, I've said it many times, is, you know, people ask me or they ask Nimsy, you know, what's the best TMS? What TMS should I pick? What cat tool should I pick? How should we implement our language technology strategy, roadmap? And say, you know, it depends. There is no best TMS out there. Sure. It really depends. And then I send them an invoice and say, you're welcome.
Thank you for your custom. Yeah,
the consultant life. Hashtag keep it real.
No, you're right. You're absolutely right. It's they do very wildly. I mean, I think, like I said, you know, Unity and Unreal have kind of brought them, you know, brought some development into some alignment. But it's just, you know, once you're in Unity and Unreal, you know, there's other, you know, there's different structures that you can have within each of those as well. So those vary from developer to developer too. So yes, there's no, there, you can't, even from a Gridly perspective, we can't, yeah, like you said, we can't have, right, there's Gridly, enjoy, thank you very much, and then off you go. There's lots of hand-holding, there's lots of kind of making sure that people are using it correctly. But I think that would apply to, you know, anything that's out there. There's just simply not a one-size-fits-all out there.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, some tools are very, you can kind of take a look at the tool and the features that it has and understands like, oh, this was developed by a translator. It's like, oh, or this was developed by a developer, right? And it's hard to make everybody happy throughout the entire localization value chain, localization workflow. But that's, like I said before, you know, if localization were simple, then most of us would not have jobs. Right, is what I tell people I've worked with my entire career, and you know, people complaining about, oh, this client doesn't know what they want, or this is so complex, or they don't know what they're doing, or the source team isn't blah 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 blah. I'm like, good, it's job security.
Keep it going. Right? Don't educate too hard. No, but surely we should be more giving than that, shouldn't we, Tucker? We should be providing that kind of one-stop shop that says, you know, okay, don't worry, we've got you. Don't worry about Tucker and his consultancy. We can look after that for you. It's all good.
Exactly. Well, yeah, but until then, I will keep sending invoices. Well, how can, you know, just watching the clock here,
yes.
What's our call to action? How can people get in touch with you? How can people find out more about localization, gaming localization, or the tool, or is there a way to schedule a demo with you?
Yes, absolutely. Yes. So gridly.com, you can just, if you go to gridly.com, and then you can book a demo through itself. And there's a 14-day trial on there, so you could try out all three of the modules for those 14 days. And if you need even further enhancement in there, then do, you know, drop us a comment through Gridly itself. I think there's, you know, there's that side of things. I think, you know, there's, I think what I would push the most is kind of, you know, is speaking to someone about what your desires might be. I think that's the thing. I think so many people, they don't even know what their desire is. They kind of say, right, well, I've got this game and I just want to localize it. And it's kind of like, okay, well, that's cool, but let's have a little chat about what, you know, what the potential pitfalls might be, for example. You know, how are you housing your audio? How are you structuring your dialogue? Are you are you having to kind of duplicate loads of work over and over again? And if you are, why? And so let's stop doing that. So have that conversation about what else Gridly can potentially do for you. But it's also a case of, I think that if there's a kind of takeaway, it's really, you know, having a structured plan about, and localization is your friend. Localization is great for you. You know, we should still, you know, we should be using, you know, the best games translators. You know, we should be kind of really kind of making games really fantastic for those other territories rather than just taking this text and making it this text.
Yeah.
And it's kind of, there's more to it than just that. So I think that, you know, we need to kind of say structured, we need to think about, you know, is there potential within the game that you're making that could, that you could fine tune to make it even more sexy for a particular territory? Is there a way that we can make it, you know, making a character, you know, act in a certain way, making a character speak in a certain way that then potentially makes it from a local, from a, you know, again, this is the whole kind of, you know, a globalization expert, you know, Kate, et cetera, would be, you know, involved in these kinds of discussions. But it's very much a case of, think about, you know, localization doesn't have to be this pain in your eyeball that you feel every time you want to release and this, God, we have to do this. It should be seen as a, this is a great way to really make things fly. Like so many, you know, you hear about the stories of games flying in Turkey. And it's kind of like, what, you know, it was doing kind of mediocre numbers in all these other places. And in Turkey, it went absolutely crazy. And it's like, all right, well, you made a Turkish version, but then there was something within the game itself that really lent itself to the Turkish culture. And they thought, this is tremendous. And they really, really went for it. So it's kind of like, I think today you can do, you can, you know, you can do far more languages than you could do back then because of physical media, of course. But it allows you to also test bed a lot of content as well. So, you know, do, you know, do try to put it in as many languages as possible. You know, creating placeholder content, small groups of people to kind of test it for their particular location. Let's do more of that. Let's really kind of embrace localization rather than going, oh God, it's localization time. Here we go again.
Yeah.
So yeah.
Well, it's always you know, you've served your time in the biz dev on the dark side, right? And it's always a hard conversation to have with a client who, I imagine nowadays you're talking to clients that are more mature clients. So you have this conversation less and less, but it's always a hard conversation to have with a client because, yeah, exactly.
Yeah, sometimes.
I mean, we're live here. I was giving you an out.
Thanks.
But it's always a hard conversation to have because at the same, simultaneously, you want to A, impress upon the client, like, don't worry, we got you, this is manageable, and B, like, localization is a lot more complex than you think it is, right? So you need to convince them that localization is a lot more complex than you even realize, and you need to convince them in a way that's not insulting them or talking down to them, right? This is why I don't like this term. You know, people say, we need to educate our clients. I don't like that term because when I say, I'm going to educate you, it's kind of condescending, right?
Sit down.
Yeah, exactly.
Here we go.
Take out your number two pencil, you know, and
listen up. Yeah, yeah.
But that having been said,
yeah,
we kind of do need to educate the client, right?
You say that behind the hand,
right?
But it's totally a thing, you know. It's kind of we still, and it was always the case back then, but it's still the case now, where, you know, developers will say, "Oh, we don't want to localize these things, or this particular item, or the weapons, or whatever it might be," and it's kind of like, but they're going to sound so rubbish in the game when all the surrounding text is localized, and then you have these weird kind of weapons or kind of items, whatever they are, in English. And it's kind of like, this is where the education is. It's like, they need to see a screenshot of this, you know, with Japanese in there, or with something that they don't understand in there, to then go, would you like to play this game? No, you wouldn't like to play this game because this looks rubbish.
Yes.
So, yeah, so people, there is, I agree with you that, you know, when you say, now sit down, little Timmy, I'm going to tell you about how stuff works in the real world.
Exactly.
Nobody wants to hear that at all. But I think that people need to be aware that, you know, if they're coming to the table with their first game, then, you know, then sit down with an LSP, sit down with you know, with a consultant, sit down with somebody who can say, right, these are the potential dumpster fires that might kind of happen upon the way on and these, and don't leave that late. That's the problem. It's kind of like, oh, well, we've done it now, so really, so we can't, we've kind of hard coded all of the item names, so we can't translate them now, we can't have this localized, and that will happen regularly, and you're like, geez, but this looks really crappy. But it's like, well, it is what it is, sorry.
Wish you talked to me first.
Right. Yeah, right. Speak to this guy.
Yeah. Well, if you're out there, I'm going to start wrapping us up here, Michael, but I'll say to the audience, if you're out there and you want to learn more about all of these potential dumpster fires, talk to Michael, the expert in dumpster fires, the expert in gaming localization. You can find
expert in dumpster fires. Brilliant. I'm going to get my cards changed.
I was going to say, put that on your business card. You need to update your LinkedIn tagline. You can find Michael on LinkedIn. You can find Gridly online, 14-day trial. You can schedule a demo, all of that stuff. Michael, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thanks very much for having me.
Yes, ladies, gentlemen, chat. We are out of time for today. If you enjoyed this NIMSY Live experience, and join us next time. In an hour or two, I don't know. But later on today, I'm talking to the wonderful Marina Pancheva, NIMSY consultant, expert in all things. This lady's very smart, hyper polyglot, really big into AI. She has some new research articles published on NIMSY.com talking about artificial intelligence. So if you are sad that we went the whole last hour and didn't once talk about artificial intelligence, thank God. Fear not. We'll be talking about that in the next hour or two with Marina. I appreciate our guests today. I appreciate my colleagues here at NIMSY Insights doing all the hard work so I can have these fun conversations. And I appreciate everybody in our industry who fills out NIMSY surveys, schedules briefings with our analysts, and sees us at conferences. It's good to see you out there. And finally, I appreciate you, the audience, who are joining us live today. All the dialogue and chat, everybody who left comments, questions, and especially criticisms. And I look forward to next time. Cheers.